freaking auto!
This is Brock and Salk.
Brock Huard is my hero.
What Brock Huard says?
No, he's not a criminal.
Subscribe to receive every episode at Apple Podcasts or on Google Podcasts.
We stink, man.
Now, here are your hosts, Brock Huard and Mike Salk.
No way!
This is the last time I accommodate you and do you a favor. Hey, can we record a day earlier this week? Sure. Does it have to be coming off of that game? Like, does it have to be the next thing when I'm emotional? Like, this has to be the week we record earlier?
Correct. Right off Pete. Right off the heels of your conversation with
Coach
Cal.
Like 5 minutes ago. Good. I swear, you. It's like I make every attempt to try to be a good guy and appease you. And instead, we have to come in here all emotional. You know I don't regulate my emotions as well as you do. Mm-hmm. So I've got to come in here now and be all emotionally regulated. Right. Should we just use podcast voice for the day? Like, is that the...
Oh, no.
No? Today's not the day for it?
No.
Mike, if you think people are turning on this podcast looking for measured calmness...
They might be.
Isn't that why they go to Brock and Salk for measured calmness after events?
Well, it's the Brock and Salk podcast. Aren't podcasts supposed to be measured and calm?
No. I love when Salk goes podcast. Pete Carroll is a football coach. He has a team that's 2-5. His quarterback is hurt. Let me tell you a story about Pete Carroll.
Yeah.
I love that Salk in the first 30 seconds framed himself as a pleaser. That's really me.
Well, am I not? Just like your Haley. Right. We're both pleasers.
Total pleasers.
Yeah.
No, and actually, you teed me up perfectly for a text I received this morning from
a friend who
said, let's see. Let me get to the meat of it.
Brock really
this is a long text.
Brock really takes the we have all day on the podcast seriously. So he's like, hold on. I can just go searching through my phone. It's from 1999. I can get to this. No, hold on a second. No. Let me just do a little quick math.
Tell Salk to ease up on the Ted Lasso positivity.
Oh.
I miss his East Coast hot takes. Okay? We need a little fire.
First of all, who'd that come from? Damon?
Didn't come from Damon.
Did it come from one of the Grahams incarnation?
No, didn't come from one of the Grahams incarnation.
Wow.
No, actually came from a coach down in Pierce County.
All right.
It's just that people count on you, Salk, to be fire.
Well, I think,
to bring emotion, not to be a pleaser, not to be Ted Lasso positivity.
I don't think I was all that positive. However, I think that let's be what I always said is I'm a realist. I'm not positive. I'm not negative. I'm just a realist.
Oh.
That's me.
Okay.
I went yesterday and thought, I watched that game last night. My immediate thought, I'm guessing like many of yours, is, okay, season's over. They're done. They're 2-5. Season's over.
Mm-hmm.
Right? They can't make the playoffs now. They're done. They're, you know, forever behind Arizona. They're nowhere close to the Rams. The Green Bay, right, is way ahead of them. Dallas is having a good year. Now the Saints are 4-2. They don't have a chance. And that was absolutely my immediate thought. And so when I went to go like prove that, because I try to prove the things I say, I went to the standings, and that's when I realized it wasn't true. Like, I can't help the fact that the NFL created a seventh playoff spot in each of the conferences this year. The Seahawks are 2-5, right? They're not good. They haven't played well, but they're 2-5. There are six teams that are clearly ahead of them in the NFC, right? Six teams they're not going to catch. Dallas is 5-1, Green Bay 6-1. Tampa's 6-1. The Saints are 4-2 with a win against you. Arizona's 7-0, and the Rams are 6-1. That's six teams.
Mm-hmm.
And in last year, those six teams make the playoffs, and the rest of this season is almost not worth playing. But this isn't last year. This is this year. And I don't mean to be Ted Lasso and believe and be super positivity, but of the rest of the teams in your conference, only a few of them have more wins than you that aren't those six. You've got Minnesota's 3-3, and they do have an edge on you. Chicago's 3-4. Falcons are 3-3. Panthers 3-4. And the Niners are 2-4. You're 2-5.
Mm-hmm.
You're right there in that same group with all of those teams. Washington, and I had Washington, Philly, New York. They all have two. But you're right there with all of those teams. And one of that group of, I'm not saying that's a good group, but one of the teams in that group of teams is going to make the postseason this year because those are the rules. So I didn't make the rules. They're 2-5. They're going to play Jacksonville next week. Is that a gimme? No.
Whew.
But it's certainly...
Will they be favored in that game?
It's not a gimme. I'm not going to tell you it is. Not the way they're playing right now. But it's certainly winnable. Jacksonville's terrible. So it's a winnable game next week. If not, then we got bigger problems. Jacksonville's 1-5. And then, in theory, you should get Russell Wilson back. And I'm not saying you're going to go on an epic run, But could you be better than Carolina, Atlanta, New York, Philly, Washington, Chicago the rest of the way? Yeah. Is Minnesota a world beater? That's clear. They've got the edge on you. That's who you're chasing, and they beat you head to head. But don't look at me and say that the postseason's definitely over. Now, if you play the way you have, it is. But you got one more game, and then in theory, Russell Wilson comes back.
Are you baking coffee cake and muffins like Ted in the morning too?
I'm not telling you that you're going to pull this off. Yes. I'm just saying today's not the day to declare it over because it's not over yet.
That's true. No, I don't think it is. World War II must win. Okay, last night, not must win. I'm quoting Kirk Ferentz there, by the way, on one of the greatest drops you're ever going to hear.
Okay.
World War II must win.
Okay. Fair. I mean, he's right. Yeah.
Yes.
I'm glad we won that
big win. Big W.
I got some ancestors who have
eat a W today.
Sure. Yeah,
that was must win.
Yes. I think Eisenhower ate the W with Jameis afterwards. He shoved three
fingers him and
down
FDR
his
were.
Right.
Yeah.
As they gathered to celebrate what was going on. Yeah.
Churchill was there.
Hatton was there, parading around.
Beautiful.
Yeah. He's just jamming fingers into his throat like the god awful Jameis Winston. All right. No, it was. Last night seemed like must win, and I honestly thought it was. And in a six-team playoff situation, it was. But in a 7-team, it's not.
And to be fair, the defense played like it was. Defense played as hard as they could play.
They gave up 13 points. How much more are you going to ask of this defense?
They played as
hard. Come up with a few more turnovers.
Yep. They played as hard as they could play, I think as well as they could play.
Don't people want them to make adjustments over the course of the game, and didn't they do that?
They did.
I mean, I'm not going to be positive the whole time here. I have some really, really negative things to say, I promise. But I will say that we demanded that they clean up that concept across the middle, and for two games, it hasn't been a problem. Agreed. Now, I don't know if Jameis Winston and Ben Roethlisberger are capable of taking advantage of that, but I know Sean Payton is. Mm-hmm. I know he's smart enough to do so, and I think that so is Mike Tomlin. So clearly, that looks to have been cleaned up. It created another problem yesterday with those running back choice routes or whatever they are, mm-hmm. but by the second half, they seem to clean that up too.
Yep.
So I'm not going to sit here and kill the defense. They look better than they have.
And they had to. I mean, they had to on a stormy night in Seattle on a Monday night with everything on the line. And that's where a lot of your experience is, certainly through the middle of your defense and Al Woods and Puna and Bobby and your two safeties. I mean, you would expect them to play, you know, play hard, play better, play with some force. And they did. And they did. They gave you every opportunity to win that game. But offensively, it was a major, major step back.
That was one of the worst offensive performances I can remember.
Yes, that was, save for DK Metcalf's 80-some five-yard touchdown, you take that out of the equation, and it was Charlie Whitehurst bad.
Yeah, they had like 150 other yards.
It was back to those early days of Pete kind of managing that 7-9 season, and just don't screw it up, just don't screw it up.
Did you expect something different? Like with Russell Wilson, Chris Carson, Damian Lewis, D. Eskridge.
I mean, I think with most of your line there outside of Damian Lewis, I think with your tight ends now, your full complement. Obviously, you're missing Chris Carson. I don't think he makes too much of a difference last night based on not being able to block DeMario Davis ever at any time, anywhere on the field. But you do have Tyler Lockett. You do have DK Metcalf. You do have your tight ends. You do have 80% of your line. You would think you could function better than that.
Yeah, I didn't expect them to be good, but I did expect them to function. I think that's a good word for it. And it just seemed like on each drive, there was a different problem. And it was just on one play, but it was enough to kill him. And I guess that's what you get when you run the conservative offense. The flip side is, did you want to unleash Geno Smith on the world? I did not. I don't think that the score is even as close as it is. If you just open things up for Geno, I have not seen one thing from Geno Smith in his time as the Seahawks quarterback, not just in these few games, but in what he's done in preseason leading up to this, to tell me that he's somebody that you want to let cook.
Other than the 98-yard drive against the Rams.
Against prevent defense.
Yep, that was about the only time, right? That was a tremendous drive. And maybe, you know, the two-minute drill in Pittsburgh to get the field goal, to get to overtime. So he's had a couple drives.
But I haven't seen anything that tells me to open it up for him, to start treating him like Kurt Warner, to start treating him like Dan Marino or John
Elway. You've seen a game-losing turnover from him every week.
That's right.
And, that's just the one thing he could not do.
In the only times that he's actually allowed to open things up, he turns the ball over.
Yes.
So I don't think that that's a reasonable expectation for Geno. So then it is, all right, how do you keep it close as long as possible and count on your defense to do something big? And unfortunately, it just seemed like each drive had an issue. First drive, you get to 3rd-and-1, right? Couple of good runs. And then Alex Collins decides to tiptoe into the hole that time. I don't know why. just hit the hole hard, one cut and go. Yep. Right? Next drive, you score a touchdown. The next one, there was something else. And then it was Gerald Everett deciding to flip the ball and lose his cool at an opponent who's on the sideline. Well, you can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Not just this year, but ever. That's never been okay. That's not new emphasis on
punting.
And
you're not good enough to do that anyway.
It's just, like, not, I mean, you just, yes. What are you doing?
Yeah.
So you're flipping the ball an opponent, and now
fifth
that
catch
drive
of the
is
year.
Gone.
Take this.
And then later it was, you know, you get yourself in a field goal range, and Geno takes a 10-yard sack, and instead of a 42-yard kick, it's a 52-yard kick in bad weather, which you can't have.
No.
So, I mean, you can kind of go through these one
yeah,
after another
you know
after
what?
Another.
There was
and then you get to third and one, Brock, yeah. And you make what I would honestly say is the worst call, regular season edition, since Jeremy Bates was here.
Whoa.
Oh, the yes. Worst play call I've seen since Jeremy Bates.
You just signed a Jeremy
and I,
Bates.
And I know that everyone's going to point to the Super Bowl. I will say regular season edition. That one, it's in, that one's in its own category, obviously. But since Jeremy Bates decided fourth and one was the best time to throw up a 50-50 ball on a fade, taking that third and one, going into shotgun, giving Alex Collins a read option look, which he's not good at anyway, against a nine-man box, was probably the worst play call I can remember.
Yeah. I think that's the one where DeMario blew it up.
Yes.
2.5 yards.
And of course he did, because there were nine guys at the line of scrimmage ready for that play. And why are you running out of the shotgun? Why are you not giving Geno even? And Geno, take it on the, if you're going to do it, take the read option. I almost lost my mind. That was the one. That's probably the play that has made me most frustrated in the entirety of...
I think that's when you said the text.
Yeah.
I think when you broke the moment of silence.
That was too much for me.
Yep, I decided, as a good friend of yours, because I am a pleaser too,
yes.
To just not text the group. Not text the group with some of my frustrations in the first half. Not text the group when Geno's burning timeouts. Not text the group when you take a 10-yard sack and you can't call a pocket pass play against a team that you know is going to tee off and going to be in Geno's lap before he can even do anything. No, I didn't text it. I don't think it was until that moment that you decided to break the silence.
Yeah, it was too much for me. That's the word. I honestly, can you think of a worse play call outside of the Super Bowl since one single play call, not like the entirety of Daryl Bevel, like one play call where you were like, that is just, it's nonsensical.
There have been a bunch of short yardage where you think you can do that, where you just run into loaded boxes and fronts and think you have James Carpenter and Breno Giacomini and Max Unger and those guys that, you know, could move a pile even with extra numbers. Oh, and Marshawn Lynch, who would take that first contact and run through it and move the pile. You don't have that. You don't have those guys. Kyle Fuller is not a great center right now. Jamarco Jones is a backup left guard, is a backup in this league. And that's who you run behind. And oh, by the way, it's the best middle linebacker in the NFC. Or actually maybe the second best. Maybe the other guy at Tampa Bay is number one. So maybe the second best middle linebacker, who had 9 tackles, 4 tackles for loss, 2 sacks in that game last night. That's double the sack total of Bobby Wagner. That's double the tackle for loss total of Bobby Wagner on the entire season. So, yeah, that was a doom play from the onset.
So let's ask the question, Brock, because we can all sit here and look at the game and know all the problems, right? There were issues with the roster, issues with the coaching, issues with the offense, issues with the defense. Godforsaken issues with special teams.
Freaking kicker.
Unbelievable. And beyond that, I mean, Al Woods jumping off sides might have been the single worst play of the game. That might be the biggest decider in whether you win or lose.
Both he and Bless, put a Ford mood on that play.
How do you
crazy.
Do that? You're and literally
Bless,
the nose guard.
Yes. And Bless Greasy and Riddick and even Levy, because you could see the director and the producer showed Al Woods like 3 times after that, and they're like, I can't even say anything. Do you want to say anything? I don't.
Well, he'd had a really good game other than
he did.
That, but that's just maybe a disastrous
maybe
play.
Maybe his best game ever as maybe. A Seahawk.
Yeah, I mean, he really played a great game, but you can't do that. Anyway, so it doesn't really matter what any of us think. What matters is, what did Russ think? He stands outside in the pouring rain for 3 hours in the cold, watching that game, frustrated
Hatless,
that he
by
can't
the way.
Be in.
He went Pete Carroll style.
He was ill-equipped for the elements.
Yeah,
I don't think he had a Gore-Tex rain-wicking outer
shell. He had to tough it out. He's a player. He's the leader. He's got to be with his guys doing his things. He's got to be tough. Tough it out. I'm a quarterback.
All right, well, regardless.
And he played his game, to be fair. He played his two-hour game beforehand.
Yeah, he'd already done his thing, Kyle.
Yep.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, Russ is out there.
Mm-hmm.
He's watching this entire game in the elements. He doesn't show any emotion during the game, nor can he. I mean, he knows the camera's going to be on him. If he has a look of disgust on what's happening out there, that's going to be talked about forever. So good on Russ. He's incredibly neutral, and that's what he does, right? The whole neutral thinking thing. Like that's how he, that's his neutral mentality. But in his heart of hearts, in his mind of minds, way back there, as he's driving home last night, what is he thinking?
On the positive side, he's thinking, man, I elevate everybody on this team. And everybody's getting a chance to feel and see what it's like without number three. Something we talked about 3 weeks ago when this injury happened. You know, now we get to see something we've not seen for a decade. What does he really mean to this team? What is his wins above replacement, right? We have said before it could be 7, 8, 9 wins in a season. And right now it's, you know, in the two games that he's missed, we're trending that direction. And there is no guarantee. There's no gimme whatsoever. And I'll be curious. I don't know. What's the opening spread on Jacksonville? 3? 3.5?
Yeah, sure.
You know, so I'm going to guess maybe 6, but I think that would be a stretch. So I think on the positive end, Mike, he gets...
There are numbers between 3.5 and 6, though. you are aware that the odds makers can go with numbers like 4, 5, 5.5. Like, there are numbers between 3.5 and 6.
Hashtag what? What
clueless.
Hashtag clueless.
Thanks.
Remember when Brock read the definition of
Seahawks -3.
Wow.
Hashtag I'm good. Long body.
All right. Gosh,
I'm over under at 43.5. That's maybe
I
even
am
more
good, by the way. Look at what I just said. What is it, Kyle? All right. Thank you.
Three, but I just wanted to make sure we knew that there were numbers, like integers even.
Hashtag between, long bow or whatever that was.
Hashtag
whatever.
Long body.
Hashtag long body. Long body.
Join the conversation.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
What is Russ
so on
thinking?
The positive side, that's what he's thinking. Yep, good. Now everybody gets a chance to see and feel. Chuck Arnold, Jody Allen, everybody. Burt Cold, John Schneider, if he didn't already know it, everybody. Everybody gets a chance, not in an arrogant, egotistical, narcissistic way, but just in the reality that I am worth every bit of my $35 million salary. I'm a franchise quarterback in this league. You watched two that are far from that in a long, long ways. And this team needs me, and I elevate everybody around me. That would be the positive side. If you want to get into the passenger seat, if Sierra's driving or you know, with his finger, he's not driving, he's in the passenger seat and he's venting, he's saying, oh my gosh, this O-line's bad. I mean, real bad. Whew. You know, I told Dan Patrick that last, you know, whatever, January, February, and it created a storm, but we're still not any better. I mean, Kyle Fuller, we got dominated. You know, that group up front just kind of dominated and laughed at us, and our running backs ran 22 times for 44 yards on the day. And then, you know, as far as a plan, goodness gracious, if I'm out there, you know, there's zone blitzing and my outlets, you know, there's a rolled corner and that's covered. I'd be running for my life tonight if, you know, we called the same plays that we tried to run tonight, because more often than not, when you looked at the replay, it wasn't as if there were wide open guys. It wasn't as if you're like, oh my gosh, Gino, just hit the broadside of the barn. I mean, he missed one cross.
Throw the ball.
Right. It's not just an accuracy issue.
Yeah, and I was screaming the same thing. Just throw it away. Just throw it away. Okay, just throw it away. Now you're in 3rd and 10, and they can mix all their coverage and zones and blitzes. And
all right, but better to be in 3rd and 10 than 3rd and 18, and you're still in field goal range.
Agreed. But as far as was he watching that going, oh, awesome, man. Sheesh, you know, we had guys running free, and Geno just missed them.
No, but he wasn't decisive. He did miss a couple of throws, especially on the run. Look, Geno's not very good. That's pretty simple. I don't think he's even a good backup. I've never thought he was a good backup. Mm-hmm. And I know I heard from people that Geno's one of the better backups in the league. I didn't believe it. Yep. And now we're seeing that.
Yep.
The real question that we have to have about Russell is, what does he think of this roster? What does he think of the scheme?
What does he think of game management? What does he think of the head coach? What does he think of all of those things as well, right?
But let's get to the brass tacks of it. What does he think about what he sees out there? I was talking to Clayton today, and John, I asked John the question, if Geno Smith started 17 games for the Seahawks this year, what is their record? He said an average backup quarterback gets you 6 to 7 wins in a season. What does this team do with Geno Smith as its quarterback in 17 games?
Mm-hmm. Well, I nailed the number as far as Vegas goes.
All right, we'll nail this one then, because this one's made up. So whatever you say could be right.
They would go 4-13.
I think that's even maybe a stretch, but I said 3 or 4.
Yep. 3 or 4.
They have Houston. This year, you got Houston. You got some really bad teams on your schedule this year, so it's possible maybe you win 4 or 5 games. But I think you're a 2 to 3 win, maybe 4 win team with Geno Smith and without Russell Wilson in this roster.
Yes.
That's my opinion of it.
And what did John say?
Well, he said 7, but, you know, John and I disagree. That's fine.
Yep.
He thinks that they're better than that.
Just says Geno's worse than the average backup quarterback.
Well, I think that, but then I also watch the other backup quarterbacks. They're all pretty bad.
Mm-hmm.
In this league right now?
Tell that to Gardner Minshew.
Yeah, no, they're pretty
There's
bad.
There's like 4 good backup quarterbacks. The
there there aren't
bad.
Many. He's not in the group of elite backup quarterbacks, but he's also, you know, and then if
and
you start...
sadly, there's no upside. I mean, this is not a young guy. How many years have I clamored? Like, hey, man, just draft Trace McSorley.
Right.
Draft someone in the, you know, draft Ellinger. Draft somebody in the 4th, 5th, 6th round. I mean, Lord knows your draft picks in those rounds over the last 6 years haven't helped you on the field much, so... Why don't you take a flyer on a younger quarterback, at least, that, you know, you could get in these moments and have some upside. There's no upside with Geno whatsoever. He's just a...
Right. But there's just, also not done. Much upside on the roster, and you start seeing all of the holes that Russell Wilson was plugging up in the dam. So yep. I think Russell's got to be thinking that. Now, here's the part where I'm not sure I would agree with Russell. I think Russell's looking at it and saying, see, this scheme doesn't really work. And I don't know that that's true. I think there's an element of... this scheme is perfectly suited to what Russ is best at. He's efficient, and he's unbelievable clutch and late. Those are Russell's two
and
best
play
skills.
Action. I mean, you have to add. And play he's action. Incredible in play
100%.
Action. Yes.
But he's incredibly efficient. Well, you need to be efficient when you are running the ball with as much balance as Pete wants to.
Yep.
And by the way, look around the league. The idea that this is just a straight-up passing league the way it was 2 years ago is not true.
Nope.
Tennessee dominating with the run, Baltimore killing it with the run. Yep. You know, all the problems that they've had in Kansas City started appearing when they couldn't run the ball. So yes. Spare me this, oh, it's just a wide open, you know, throw the ball all over the place league. This is not the Big 12, brother. It's not. This is the NFL, and you absolutely have to run the ball. And Russell's as equipped as anyone in this league to run play action, be efficient, and play a balanced offense that Pete Carroll wants. And also, he's as good late in the game as you'd want.
Mm-hmm.
So this offense and this style is still set up for Russell Wilson to succeed and look great.
Yep.
But that may not be what he wants to do.
Yep. I think that's all very, very fair. And then I think the very crux of it all, Mike, you know, driving home last night, going to drive home Sunday after Jacksonville. You know, we'll see. Is it then the bye week that follows and then Green Bay?
Yep.
So, you know, there'll be a little time, but we have no idea. Ultimately, that specialist is going to look at the finger and see, as I told you on the show this morning, that, you know, see where the healing is. So, you know, we'll see how many more games he'll get to drive home. And then the ultimate just kind of crux of it that I don't think it's comfortable for any of us to say out loud, nor to judge, but the whole crux of it all is, do I believe in Pete's system still? Do I not what you just laid out from an offensive system and Shane Waldron and the baby steps are going to take this year to install it. Like, just big picture. Do I believe in Pete and John in where this thing is built and going to be built moving forward? You know, what the foundation is and what it isn't, you know, with personnel the last 4 or 5 years, you know, or do I watch that game last night if I'm Russell and look at the Saints and go, man, this dude's got some talent. I mean, Alvin Kamara is, remember 2 years ago what Russ wanted? I want stars. And one of their biggest stars didn't even play. Michael Thomas is an absolute star. Alvin Kamara is a star. That old line is good.
DeMario
Davis is a star.
But hold on.
The corner is a star.
Look on the, just hold on a moment, though. On the offensive side of the ball, who has more stars outside the quarterback position?
New Orleans. New Orleans has more stars. You have DK, and Tyler's a good player.
I mean, you have two wide receivers that are better than anyone else on their team, and you have two tight ends that are better than their tight ends.
Oh, Michael Thomas would have a word.
All right, but he's not there.
And Alvin Kamara would.
Alvin Kamara is right there.
10 passes last night.
Alvin Kamara is a wonderful player. I'm not trying to overlook him. That's one.
Yes.
I didn't see any other stars on that offense other than Alvin Kamara.
Well,
not one.
Their offense kind of proved it out. They scored 13 points.
I'm aware of that. But before we get carried away into Russ's pointing across the sideline and saying, I want that, the grass is a whole lot greener over there, I don't know that he's looking at that wide receiver group and saying, I want that over DK Metcalf,
physical
freak show. I think
he's looking at it going, Sean Payton has to deal with Jameis. Oh, my gosh.
Well, that's possible, too.
Hit the broadside of the barn. Ooh. I mean, yeah, you know, you're not going to elevate any of those other guys. You're going to get a screaming match with Trey
Smith
because those dudes
are tuning
you out.
But I'm just saying that the one place the Seahawks do actually have some talent is on the outside in terms of weaponry at the wide receiver spot.
But does it matter if they're not going to design an offense that features them? What's the point? What's the point of having all this stuff? And that's what Russell's really been clamoring for the last 6 years. If I'm going to be the centerpiece of this whole thing, build it around me, and their philosophies are completely different. Yeah. Pete Carroll believes I'm going to build this around you by you do what I say and you play within my system. And Russell Wilson saying, I'm better than this. You need to build a team that highlights everything that I can do. And their offense and their whole personnel scheme is completely two ways.
So did that not happen this year? I mean, Russell got the coordinator he wanted from the system he wanted. I mean, like, didn't that happen this year?
And it looked that way for six quarters. That's and then it looked just right back to where it was before. So we could be a prisoner of this game and say, you know, just comparing rosters. But when Russell Wilson was in there, it still didn't look the way he projected it to be.
There's an element of that, but it is also hard to look at what Pete's done with Geno Smith and say he's doing it wrong.
Right.
What else is he supposed to do with Geno Smith?
Absolutely.
I mean, there's no other option.
No.
So the question is, what happened after the? You're basically talking about the Vikings game and the beginning of the Rams game and the end of the Titans game, right? That sort of two-game stretch of play.
This crew, but you have to add it on to the last 4 years of the offense looking the way it had.
I don't know that I can, because you brought in somebody else to do it.
You had three coordinators over the time of Pete Carroll, and has it ever looked really any different than it does at the, by the time
I think
Russell
I would
Wilson
disagree with
injured.
That. When Daryl Bevel was here, the Seahawks offense looked bizarre. It never looked like a real NFL offense. I can't say that about the team this year. They've had their struggles, certainly up front, but I don't know that I would look at them and say they didn't look like an NFL offense with Russell in there.
After six quarters of the season, it didn't look like an NFL offense.
I don't think I would say that.
I mean, remember, we also have had some stretches. Daryl Bevel was there when Russell in the second half of 15, you know, set historic numbers. That was Daryl Bevel after the bye week, and, you know, when he was down in Mexico and got called out and everything, he went on a pretty darn historic stretch. Mm-hmm. It was shoddy last year through the first half of eight games of 2020 season where Russell was the MVP, where it was a pretty historic stretch, pretty record-breaking stretch of numbers. I mean, we have seen stretches of it with both of those previous coordinators.
It's challenging because I think Russell thinks that he's something he's not. I think Russell thinks the things he's best at aren't the things he's best at. And I also think that Howdy has some points that, you know, they are designing something that doesn't always take, you know, isn't built around the quarterback. It is maybe built around the things Russell's actually best at,
right?
But he wants to be better at something else.
Yep, I think that's fair. And then all through it all, you have, to Howdy's point, I think a lot of the folks on the outside's point, you know, through the optics of a defensive-minded head coach who's going to play a game and is very comfortable playing a game like last night that is a one-possession game into the fourth quarter, that's how he sees, you know, it best practice. And you know what? For a decade, we have had some of the most success in the history of this franchise. Not some. We've had for 10 years. Playoff run after playoff run after playoff, 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 playoff. Win, 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 win.
Well, and that's what makes it hard for some of this criticism. It's like, okay, yeah, it really hasn't worked, huh? Right? With a roster where every year the first round pick is nothing, the second round pick does nothing, where Howdy, you've drafted two guys since 2012 that are impact players on your team today. Two. Since, well, starting with the 2013 draft, that are impact players on your team today. Two. And yet you're going to criticize Pete Carroll and say that his system doesn't work? Really? Every year they go to the playoffs. Every year they give it a shot. Every year they win more games than they lose. They set records, this, that, and the other. Most successful franchise in the league during that time other than maybe New England. And you want to tell me that Pete's system doesn't work? Really? With Butkus for star players other than Russ?
Or do you want to peel the layer back a little bit and always have that question you wondered, was it Belichick or was it Brady? Mm-hmm. Is he kind of look at it? Has it been Pete and has it been Pete's system and Pete's philosophy? Or has it really just been Russell that's covered so many ills and so many warts for so many seasons with an O-line and a roster that has been troubled? And, you know, we've got now two games to show it. And I don't think you can say, and I think the easiest say, well, I'm sorry, you don't even have a capable backup. You know, you have Curtis Painter. No, Geno's a little better than Curtis Painter.
He is.
You know, and he may not even be a league average backup, but at least this gives you for the first time a chance to evaluate. It gives Jody Allen, it gives the entire organization, I think, a chance to evaluate. When there was friction this offseason, they can diminish it all they want, they can spin it all they want, but you heard some of the release valve of Russell and his camp and his team this offseason just say, hey man, you know, we're just not going to play the company line for the next 10 years. We're just not going to do it. There's some frustrations here, some things that have to be remedied and fixed for this thing to move forward. And now we're getting a look at life without Russell, and it is it's a tough, especially on offense. It's a tough, tough watch.
I'm glad we're having this conversation because it's helping me clarify some of my thoughts. And in it, I think I have maybe finally crystallized what I think about this coaching staff and how they've handled the offense. I am not ready to say or willing to say that they are holding Russell back or holding the team back. But I'm also not willing to say that they are doing anything to push them forward.
Mm-hmm. They're staying in neutral.
I don't think
didn't
it's,
you just
yeah.
say it's neutral?
They're not adding to the capability. And you watch that game. They weren't scheming people open. There wasn't something they did to help make Geno Smith look better than he is. I don't know that they're making and holding him back, or that they're holding Russell back, or that they're not allowing him to have success because they don't want to let him, or they force him to hand the ball off too much or any of that. Yep. But are they doing the, you know, look, Russell himself got himself in trouble last year, right? They were playing well, and then he wasn't. He started turning the ball over at a rate that was unacceptable to Pete Carroll or any other coach in the NFL. You can't turn the ball over like that.
Mm-hmm.
But and that's not on the coaching staff. That was on Russell. But what did they do next to try to give him the next options, the next ability to evolve the system into some of the mid-range stuff? And did they give him the next options? I don't think they're putting him in positions to fail. Yeah. I think they might not be helping him into the extra positions to succeed.
I think all of that is completely fair. I think that is well-reasoned and well-observed. Let's also remember why Russell felt like he had to step on the gas and push the initiative, because Russell, his greatest talent when he went through his Rolodex of gifts and talents is to protect the football, right? When you, and that is efficiency. That's wrapped up in efficiency. That's the essence of the pass efficiency rating, is your touchdown interception, and he's thrown one this year.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, you know, last year as they get going in this, oh my gosh. This is the worst defense in the history of the league.
Right, you got to step it up.
So now I've got to score, and I can't just go out there.
That's on him. That defense did get better over time, and if he had been more patient with it, maybe things could have worked out better last year. Yeah, you're right, Brock, when you start talking about elite. But let's talk about the elite of the elite, okay? Because there's a lot of different cuts of meat. Right, we'll talk about. Like, I know Brock. You know, one of us likes brisket. How do you make a brisket? You got ribs. You got all the different cuts of meat. But one is truly elite, and that's steak. Right? A steak is the one that stands supreme. And that's why you got to think about heading to Ascend Prime and check out the elite steak selection. Beyond the panoramic views of the 31st floor in downtown Bellevue, Ascend Prime Steak and Sushi, dedicated to providing guests with next-level culinary experience, heightened on the world's best steak. Hand-selected premium beef selection curated by the culinary team featuring, you ready?
Oh, hit me.
Prime American steaks. Angus beef, wet aged for 28 days.
Ooh.
Everything from New York strip to filet mignon.
You're not doing that at home.
Wet aging?
No.
How do
no.
you wet age? Howdy?
You don't even want to know.
Right, you don't want to do that.
This is like making the sausage. You don't want to know. You just want to experience
you
the
You just want to have wet aging.
Yes.
You got prime dry aged American steaks. Angus beef, dry aged for a minimum of 45 days. Bone and ribeye to the 45-ounce Seahawk chop.
Oh,
that's a big chop. How about luxury Wagyu Angus crossbreed steaks? Now, I've had one of these. From outside skirt steak to cap of ribeye. The crossbreed steaks are awesome. Like two different types of cows. It's really unbelievable.
And if you're not big into beef like I am, you don't understand that there are many different kinds of cows that produce different marbling in the meats beyond just USDA Prime Choice, etc. It's a valuable thing to understand. If you get a good mix, you're in for something.
How about purebred A5 Wagyu, prized A5 Wagyu filet mignon, and the cream of the crop, a privilege for them to serve, the Miyazaki Prefecture A5 Wagyu, the world's best A5 Wagyu filet mignon.
Goodness.
I think that's what I had when I was there.
Whoa.
Where it tastes almost like a cross between bacon and steak. It's ridiculous.
It's just marbled
and butter.
It's almost like we had a couple of ounces of it, and you were like, okay, I can't eat anymore. It's too rich. It was unbelievably good. Ascend, one of the first restaurants in the U.S. to get the Japanese exclusive designated Miyazaki Prefecture A5 regularly available on their menu. So that is Elevated Dining. Make reservations to indulge, and that is indulging, don't get me wrong, in the Northwest Elevated Steak Experience. Where else but at ascendprime.com. Well, hopefully there's going to be a baseball off season this year, Brock. I mean, we're going to have the World Series kicks off tonight. I know everybody's rooting against the Astros.
They're going to win.
They're going to win. I mean, just get used to it now.
You can hate on them.
That's a good team, man.
Yep.
I have so much. I don't know why I have so much trouble hating them. I know I should, especially as a Mariner fan.
Yeah, it bothers me a lot.
I know. It bothers a lot of people.
It really bothers
me. It bothers me. I wish I hated them more.
It bothers Titus.
They have just a lot of players I like.
Springer's not there anymore.
I know,
Michael.
I love him, but I love Bregman.
They have one of the three most objectionable owners in sports.
I know, that guy's awful. I can't stand him.
Bregman has the most punchable face in baseball. Correa is so disliked
by
a lot of people.
And whiny. Ugh.
They pay no punishment as players for their cheating over and over.
They take no responsibility for anything they do. They paint everybody else as the aggressor and them as the victim. Oh, it's awful.
So I know their general manager a little bit. He is married to my ex-girlfriend's best friend.
Here we go. Now
so
we
I knew James
now
a long time ago. James Click is their general manager. He was working at Baseball Prospectus at the time, and I met him years ago, and you know, went out to eat with him when I was with my ex, and he was with his still wife. And so like I knew him a long time ago, and it's a cool story that he's like moved up and up and up, and now he's actually the general manager of a baseball team that's about to win the World Series. So I do have like a little bit of a soft spot personally there, but they got some players. Like, how do you not like Altuve when he's not playing against you? How do you not like Bregman and the way he plays the game when he's not playing against you? How do you not admire some of the way they just roll out talent after talent, and they're not doing it by outspending everybody. They're not the Yankees. They're doing it by being smart and spending a realistic amount of money. So they're not the Astros or they're not the A's or the Rays who just sort of embarrass themselves by not being able to sustain it. It is exactly what you're looking for.
Yes.
That is in so many ways the model. In other ways, I get the horrible parts to it and the owners got off on the ex-GM and the people they had in that organization and that bro-y culture and Yuri Gurriel. Like, there's a whole bunch of things to, you know, hate about them. But I don't know, for whatever reason. Like, I see Bregman, I see Altuve, Brantley. Like, don't you like those guys? Jordan Alvarez?
Oh, gosh. And, you know, I was chatting with Goldie about this.
Howdy's nodding. He may not like it.
No, I admire the Astros for how they've done it. I hate the team. I hate everything about them other than the fact that I admire the way they did it. Yeah. Ugh. Gross. Nasty. Yuck. And it's so exacerbated by the fact that they were just, like, we threw a parade when they got added to the AL West because they were such a joke. And they'd been a joke forever. Even when they had great players, it was still a joke. And now, like, they did the right thing, and they paid. Yep. They received the rewards. It just sucks. It stinks.
And it continues. And you thought, well, maybe when Springer's gone, and maybe Correa will go, and then maybe he'll just dry up. But they're young talent, and they're young arms. I was saying to Goldie, watching the game with him the other night after a production meeting, I'm like, who is this pitcher?
Framber Valdez, right? I mean, it's not
guy?
Even – McCullers isn't even pitching
no,
for them.
And he said, well, they did a pretty smart thing, and they saw a little market inefficiency, and they went into the Dominican Republic and found young, powerful kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, speaking my kind of language with power sources and huge strength, and you know, from just a projection standpoint, said, man, these guys just have the body types to grow into it, you know, to grow into tremendous power. And we're going to sign them at a really young age, and we're going to grow, and we're going to develop them, and boom, the fruit of that risk or the fruit of the, you know, that market inefficiency is now in bloom as they are, as you said, right there in the rotation, pitching themselves into a World Series.
And that's where you got to get. So how are you going to get there? Because ultimately what they do is irrelevant. Is what are you going to do? You were good this year. You won 90 games, more than the Braves, by the way. Two more. Which should be not that much of a, like, okay, they're in different divisions, but still, it's kind of annoying. Like, the Braves won 88 games, you won 90, and you're sitting home, they're playing for the World Series. That's a little aggravating, but okay. Them's the breaks. That's what you got to do. You've got to get past Toronto and Boston and New York and Houston and Tampa and Chicago. Like, that's the gig. That's what's in front of you. So how are you going to do it? Well, you've got Ken Griffey Jr. now as part of your ownership group. I don't know whether that means that you're instantly going to be transported to success, but hopefully that is another voice advocating for what needs to be done on the monetary financial side to get you over the top.
Is that a voice that's beneficial in free agency?
It might be, as might be Mitch Haniger's voice in his Players Tribune article and all the stuff around the culture.
I loved how you talked about some of the soft things that this could potentially do, but the hard facts of it is you added another purse. Like, you added more money to be a part of this whole thing. It's diversifying. At the very baseline, you add money to your group. There's got to be something there.
No, I don't think so.
They literally gain no financial incentive from adding to their ownership group.
Right.
Literally none.
Right.
Name.
Value, no doubt.
There's a lot of name value. I don't think Ken Griffey Jr., they didn't need to add him because they needed the extra
not
cash.
Not saying they need they would, the
I mean,
extra
Ken Griffey's
cash.
Got money, but he didn't have money.
But he bought in. He didn't get it for free. He bought that from the ownership group.
Well, he bought it from one of the other minority owners who now owns a little bit less. I mean,
which
like,
they let him go in because
Jr. doesn't have billions of dollars. Like, he's got a little money. They're not, like, spending more because now they have Jr. He brings other things. He's not there for money. You get financial guys for money. You get Jr., A, for the recruiting, and B, for the ability to be in that boardroom and have a completely different like life experience than any of those other guys. Yep. To be able to tell you what it's like to actually be on a baseball team. That's what you get Jr. for.
Yep.
Trust me, it's not for his money.
And who's still connected with players, right? Who still, you know, could go to an all-star game and the heads turn, right? Like, wow, Griffey's here, right? I mean, still has that level, and I think commands that level of respect years and years and years later, is one of the greats to ever play the game. And is not just an absentee. He's been in and around this organization, right? He's made lots of visits in spring training. He's done some instructional stuff at the minor league level. I mean, he wants to be involved.
And
to me, that's more important
language.
Than anything, more important than his clout, more important than his dollars. He wants to be involved in this thing because I think he sees what you see, what I see, and that is, man, this thing is turning.
Yeah.
They have waves of young talent. This is different than what it's been for the last 20 years. Like, I have a chance to buy in now at this stage of my life and actually realize a little bit what Magic Johnson's done with the Dodgers. Like, this thing is now. This thing is turning, and there's enough young talent, if the right moves are made, that we can turn this city back into what it was when I played.
But he also has, Brock, that experience of what didn't happen in 96, 97 when they didn't go over the top and they didn't add when they needed to, and I think that should be a valuable piece here. Look, they're going to add. So now the question is, how do you do it? You got five huge names out there, all at shortstop. Let's just throw Corey Seager out because he's not coming here. Now you've got four names left. You got Carlos Correa, Javier Baez, Trevor Story, and Marcus Semien. You got five names, let's call it four, that could legitimately be on your radar screen heading into the offseason. So I talked to Jerry Dipoto about it on Thursday. I brought up the names. I know he's not going to tell us who he's going after, but wanted to know what's the strategy in determining who to go after.
You know, for us, one of the key elements is we have a shortstop that we love. And, you know, JP's our shortstop, and we feel like he is, you know, an anchor on our infield and an emotional leader for our team. So one of the things that's important to us is finding a player who is adaptable and willing to move around the field and maybe get a little uncomfortable. And there's some of those guys that already have done that in their career. Guys like Semien and Baez have done that.
So he does mention two of them by name, doesn't indicate they're going to go after them. But look, Semien played second base this year. Baez grew up playing second base because they had Addison Russell at shortstop. And then last year when he went to the Mets, Furcal was already at shortstop. So he's kind of played both middle infield positions. You interested in the possibility of both those guys here, one at second, one at third? I am.
Both, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah,
count me in. Are you interested in one of those guys at second base and trading for Jose Ramirez at third? I am.
I love Jose Ramirez.
I bet you do.
He is my one
body,
of ones on the
body
trade
clone.
Market. I love.
I think people need to remember, I'm just looking at last year's WAR totals, and I know WAR is not the be-all, end-all, but it's, you know, a good, simple way of looking at a player. So, let's see. Baez, I think, was like a 4.5 or 4.9 win player last year. Just that your guy, Jose Ramirez, was over 7. Trevor Story was in the 4s. Correa's in the 7s. I mean, those are the kinds of players you're talking. Semien was in the 7s. Where was Kyle Seager?
Oh, I know the answer, but
2. He's a 2 win player. So
is JP? 5?
He was a 3.8 or something like that, 3.9, right? Ty France was 4.2, I want to say. I'm doing that from memory, but those are pretty close
Haniger's
to being
in the
accurate.
Threes.
Haniger was in the 3s also. Kyle Seager's a 2-win player. That includes his defense. That includes it all. He's a 2-win player who was making more money than anyone else on the Mariners last year. That's why he's not going to be here. Mm-hmm. All right. And I know that people want to say it's personal or this, that, and the other. Maybe there's elements of that. But the reality is he's a two-win player who was making too much money to justify that. And the opportunity in free agency and in the trade market is to get a 4-8 win player. Think about the difference there. And if you can add one at second and add one at third, how much better are you next year?
Oh, worlds better.
Worlds better.
If your second baseman and third baseman are in the top 10 at their position in the league, you are a completely, you're a whole team. You're a finished team at that point.
If you were to make those moves, if you were to pay premium, because you're going to pay premium yep. for that kind of talent, and let's say you sign Baez because you kind of like his edge. I kind of do too. I think it'd be a fun recruiting trip to watch him.
I'm still
going to
go Semien first, but okay, yeah. Well, either one. Let's say Semien.
Oh, you'd go Semien ahead of Baez?
Yeah.
Baez's play style is not necessarily what Jerry DePoto and the Mariners have been looking for.
He's a free swinger. He's not a controlled zone guy.
Strikes out a lot. He's very streaky. Okay.
Not familiar with the American League. Like, if I have my druthers here, it's probably Semien.
Okay. Okay, probably. He lived out on the West Coast, lived in the Bay Area, played in the division.
Yep.
Right? Has, you know, history and background and knows what T-Mobile is and knows what the Northwest is. And if he wants to be here and they want to pay the premium for that, great. Okay, so it's Semien at second. And let's say then you do have to make a decision. And you said trade for Jose Ramirez?
Yeah, you have to.
Do you have enough assets now? Oh, do you have enough waves of
you've
talent?
You've got more assets than anybody.
Okay, so you feel comfortable pulling the trigger?
I don't know exactly what that deal is, but do I feel comfortable having that conversation? For sure.
Will I give up one of my best arms and not Julio Rodriguez?
Yep.
Yeah, I probably would do that.
Yep.
Did you know that Jose Ramirez, he looks like he's on Miguel Cabrera body path? He had like 25 bags last year. He steals like 20-plus bags a year, and he plays
insane
defense.
You know Jose Ramirez has a necklace
defense.
With a picture of himself?
As he should.
Love it.
So does Howdy. No wonder he likes him so much. They both have necklaces with their own picture on there.
Yes.
Personally, when I hear Jerry DePoto talking about that in that cut with you, everything lit up to me about Chris Bryant. Postseason experience, positional flexibility, plays first, third, corner outfielders, can play center in a pinch. He's younger than most of these guys already. He is an experienced bat. Like he's everything. He's a grinder personality. He's from the West Coast. Like, to me, that is the guy. That's a cornerstone piece that I feel really good
about. I think there's something to that. I know that they've liked him before, right? Trade deadline this past year, Baez and Bryant were both potential targets of the Mariners. So I don't think you're looking up the wrong tree there. I think he's going to be a tough putt for them because, again, always been in the National League. My understanding is that he really enjoyed himself in San Francisco, wanted to stay there. They may want to keep him. We'll see what their financial situation looks like. But I think that's going to be a tougher ask for them to go get him. But that's not to say you shouldn't be kicking the tires there and trying to work it out. And I think there is a lot of value to Chris Bryant. He's also had some injuries, though.
Yes.
I mean, like, he's not a slam dunk.
I don't think anyone's a slam dunk in free agency, especially in this
class. Okay, question.
Well, Correa is, but you're not going to get him.
Okay,
Correa is about as close to a slam dunk as you're going to get.
Question.
That guy's unbelievable.
I'm raising my hand. Question.
Yes. Are you still here?
I am. You two, stop it. You're barking right up Howdy's tree. He loves this. Okay, so you make the move for Semien. That's where your cash is going to go.
Yep.
Okay, here's a question.
Would
you rather trade? Would you rather trade for Jose Ramirez? Or would you rather trade for an elite arm?
No. Do not trade for an elite arm. I am so adamantly against trading for an elite arm in the offseason. And here's why. You have no idea how that guy's going to start the next year. If you want an elite arm, you should make sure you get somebody who's performing at their peak in the season that you need them. That's a mid-season acquisition to me. Like, who would have known that Robbie Ray was going to do what he did last year? Who knew that Carlos Rodon was going to be who he was last year? There are guys who all of a sudden figure it out or who come back to form in the middle of a season, and you need to catch that lightning in a bottle.
There's some validity there. I will also answer that I would rather have the big bat because I think it's a little bit more predictable, and I think the biggest problems you have are with your lineup. You need it, Brock. Okay. You're just looking at your lineup last year. There were too many days where it was non-competitive. And if you were to make it competitive night in, night out, which is also cheaper and easier to attain plus safer, to me that seems a lot easier to do. You do have a lot of young pitching. You have been able to, if not develop it, do what you did with Paul Sewald, where you bring him in, see something about his delivery and about his stuff that's not being taken advantage of elsewhere, and turn him into something better. Chris Flexen's another example. I think you're capable of improving your pitching and then spending some money on more of the Taiwan Walker types. I don't know who that is this offseason.
I do.
Who?
His first name is James and his last name is Paxton.
<All right. laughs>
and it's time.
He'll be
and
back.
And it's time
worry.
He pays it back, like Ken Griffey Jr.
You worry. He'll be freeze. Back.
I don't mind them signing James Paxton. Go ahead. Just That's don't right. keep you from signing other things yeah. because
he's not
going to
be slotted into your 5-man no. rotation just because you signed him.
First but if you want to sign James Paxton, he could absolutely Paxton. Be like
$2.5 million. He comes in 30 days into the season.
Totally.
Yeah. Fine.
I got no issues with that. I think that's
but
actually
that's
a pretty good deal.
That's not where your bread's buttered in this offseason.
But you need to do some of those things. You've got to take some chances like that and see what develops. And I think they realized last year you just need more, mm-hmm. right? Sheffield unfortunately didn't work. And what's the guy's name who got hurt? I keep wanting to call him Jakubauskas, but
Mishevitz?
No, the lefty, the other lefty who started at the beginning of the
we can
year.
You and I can never remember.
Margavich. And then, Dunn turned into nothing, got hurt. And, you just had, unfortunately, Paxton. That's four guys you were sort of looking at starting rotation depth that all didn't work out. So, yeah, you're going to, maybe it's another shot with Tyler Anderson. We'll see if he's another guy who comes around for another tour next year. So you got to have to do some of those things in your rotation. But your rotation's going to get better by your, again,
Emerson
we said this
and
last
Hancock
year.
Hancock and your youth.
Emerson Hancock, George Kirby, Matt Brash, Williamson. I mean, those four guys specifically,
yep.
that's how your rotation's going to get better. Logan Gilbert continuing to develop. That's your future path to your rotation getting better, and then adding in all likelihood some of those free agents, and then if I think Howdy's right, as a trade deadline acquisition, looking for your Justin Verlander. I can spin all that pretty
Look,
easily
for your Max Scherzer at the deadline when the time is right, and you know you're getting a quality number one pitcher who's in his prime, who's ready, who's pitching great and healthy. That's what you do. And they another thing with the bench this year, they're not going to roll out veteran minimum guys on the bench. They're not going to churn through 35 different guys on the bench. They're going to get real major league players to come off the bench for this team and not have liabilities in the roster every day. There's a lot of opportunity, and I think they're going to seize it in a lot of different ways.
You know what I'm hearing? I'm feeling with Ken Griffey now coming back to the ownership team. I'm just hearing old time religion.
Not
in the batter's box, but in the ownership box. That old time religion lives.
This is Brock and Salk's Blue 88. We take you to the field as Brock Heward breaks down three football questions as only he can.
Now here's your hosts, Brock Heward and Mike Saul.
All right, let's finish things up here with a little Blue 88, Brock, and we will start here. Question number one for you. And apparently this was a Titus question, so I appreciate him sending it in, your son Titus.
Yep.
Who's better right now, Quandre Diggs or Jamal Adams?
Quandre Diggs. And I think, honestly, that was some of the reason now as I look in the rearview mirror at his little statement that he tried to make at the end of training camp. He was a good teammate. He was a good soldier, right? He said it publicly. He was tweeting publicly and very happy about Jamal getting his deal. And then he made his case and made his stance for a week or whatever it was. Like, yep, I like mine. I like mine now. Because if you're going to pay him the highest paid safety salary in the league, and he can't do X, Y, and Z, and I can, and I don't know, I know that I don't have his notoriety. I wasn't the fifth pick in the draft. I can't rush the passer like he did in 2020. But you know what? There's a lot of things that I do better. And overall, Mike, if you were to say to me, hey, who could you not live without? Like if you were to have to lose one of those guys here, if they get banged up and they're out 5 or 6 weeks, yeah, I don't think you can afford to lose Quandre Diggs. Much better in coverage. He'll come up and hit you. And last night, even got Brian Greasy, the old quarterback, excited in the booth. Like, that was teaching tape, man. That was stopping power on Alvin Kamara. You know, one of the best backs in the league with a couple of the thickest thighs you're going to find, especially in the open field. So, yeah, I think Jamal Adams is playing second fiddle to Quandre Diggs. I think Quandre does more. And the fact that you've paid him $18 million and traded two first-rounders instead of, what did he trade for Quandre? Fifth-rounder?
Something like that. Yeah.
Fifth-rounder? Picks.
He's making a third of the salary? Yeah, you're getting value in one, and you overpaid dramatically for the other.
All right, question number two. heard Pete say that his team was close, right? He had a level of optimism coming even out of that game that the team was close to really being able to be where he wanted them to be. Are they? Are they close?
Everyone's close in the NFL. Heck, even the Lions are close in a couple of their games as they've come back, right? They're winless. Their roster is horrendous. They're in year one of a total and complete rebuild and reboot and makeover. But I'm sorry, man. That is the one that I just... Okay, the NFL is... It's all about being close. That's the way everything is built in this league. You're going to have one possession games, by and large, 80% of the time, no matter who the teams are, Mike. So I get it. I understand it. That is the spin that Pete has to have. That's how he's got to keep people on board. It's how he's got to keep the momentum going. Oh, we've only lost three games by 15 points, and it's a play here. It's a play there. Jimmy Lake said the same thing before the Arizona game. Wow, we're three plays away from being 4-1 in conference. Yeah, but you were a play away from Cal fumbling at the goal line to being a one-win team, too. So, you know, I just... And you were a play away from the Arizona QB throwing a pick on a screen pass in the fourth quarter from being down 23-3 and losing that game at Arizona. That is football. That is, especially in the style with which they play, you know, to play conservatively and try to get a game to a fourth quarter, you're going to be close, Mike. So I have a very hard time absorbing that, much like I hear Nick Holt say, oh, we're young. We're a young football team. I puke that out of my mouth like lukewarm milk in Revelation. Don't tell me we're young. Don't tell me we're close. Those things don't fly at the collegiate level, the professional level anymore, and I just simply don't buy those arguments.
All right, finally, question number three. Since you brought up Jimmy Lake, that's where I was going to go with this final question. I mean, what happened in the desert? They got a win. I said Monday, though, that I feel like that win may have actually been the worst possible result for them because they played so badly that it's clear your problems aren't fixed, but you won, so it's harder to do something about it. Where are the Huskies at right now, Brock?
Well,
where
they go down. Yeah, they go down to the farm, which has been a terrible matchup for them. And to me, this one will, I think, further expose kind of what you are and what you are doing and what adjustments you are willing to make and not make. Because this is a Stanford team that beat them last year. This was a Stanford team that a couple years ago, with your experience, and Jacob Eason went down there and you lost to, and they were nothing but true freshmen on their O-line. And you had no business losing that game whatsoever, but they did. That was one of the last, I think, just straw that broke the camel's back for Chris Peterson, you know, because he felt like he couldn't reach his team. So this has been a bad matchup for you. And I will be more than curious to watch how they're going to attack in every phase of this game. Because if they just think they can line up and, you know what, we'll play our safe, conservative box count and we'll let you run for 5-7 yards, they're going to go up and down the field and they're going to throw one-on-ones and create mismatches and beat you. And you're going to be sitting there staring at 3-5. I understand your sentiment to a degree, Salk. I would say, you know, and some of this is being, you know, a Husky in my blood and having that in my background and certainly my nephew there, that you lose to Arizona the other night. I mean, the wheels are so completely off from a recruiting standpoint and a momentum standpoint. I mean, they already largely are. Your recruiting class, I think, is ranked in the 50s right now, which is abysmal. And I think as big a warning sign as anything. Certainly the alumni and the boosters and everybody around the program feel that. But there's going to be a lot more answered this week on the farm. Oregon, you know, coming up later in the year, the rest of the games. Can you somehow, some way get to 6 wins? I think it's a tall, tall task.
Well, there you go. That is Blue 88 3 football questions. I don't know, man. I see what you're saying. Obviously, you know, losing a game like that is embarrassing, but at least it lets you know where you're at.
Yep.
And maybe even spurs action. And not that I'm looking for anybody to lose their job. Maybe it's not the head coach that is the problem. Maybe there's other issues there, but the idea of like playing that badly, most people turn it off, and then like you don't even really get the credit for the win because of who you're playing. I don't know. Yeah. That was a tough watch, man.
It was a really tough watch. There's a bunch of tough watches. Seahawk offense is a tough watch. I got Colorado, Oregon. Colorado's a tough watch. The Husky offense, save for the fourth quarter, and Dylan finally pushing the ball down the field and then playing to their strengths. I think that is, you know, lastly, the hardest thing. I think I said this to you on Monday as well. Like, you have some talent, Mike. You have some guys that are dudes, like, you know, legitimate dudes. Your two corners are NFL corners. Your young receivers have a chance, and you got to keep them around. You're right. That is the other thing, Mike, in this day and age. You got to sell your program not just to the recruits on the outside. You got to sell it to your players on the inside. And last year, there was a pretty large mass exodus. A bunch of receivers, including Puka Nacua, who's making big plays happen for BYU, they left stage right. So you have a big sales job over the next 5 weeks internally to your locker room, to your players, to your boosters, to your alumni, in what is going to be an incredibly active year. Already four FBS Power 5 jobs are open. That will not be the end of it, and that turnover will create other turnover. It is going to be a pretty chaotic offseason.
Well, and it's just such a, you know, that idea of being able to sell is important to being a head coach, not just in college, but in the pros. And you know, Pete's in a similar spot this week. Not that he needs to sell to the outside world, but he's got to sell his team on the fact that they're not out of it yet.
No question.
That they've got to go play hard, that there is a seventh playoff spot available this year. And amazingly, as tough as things have been through the first 7 weeks, he said he hasn't been 2-5 since his first year at USC. That's what he told me. You think that tastes good in Pete's mouth? I don't think so. I don't think he's too happy about the way that is. And so, you know, there's an opportunity here. You're playing a bad Jacksonville team with the hope of a bye and maybe Russell Wilson afterwards. So, Brock, we'll talk again next week. Looking forward to it. Good to do a little early. Yeah, I was mad at you earlier because of all the passion.
But I
today.
Crystallized your thoughts.
Yes,
I
appreciate that. Thank
You're
you.
Welcome.
Thank you for being there for me to talk to. That's an important part of my life. All right. We will speak with you guys again next week. Until then, the hay
is in the barn.
See everybody.
Get to the chopper!